Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm your host, Maddie Alm, registered dietitian and former professional runner. Today's guest is professional runner for Puma and mom of four, Sarah Vaughn. Sarah is based in Boulder, Colorado, where she currently trains for the marathon. She grew up in a small town in Nebraska and went on to run for the University of Colorado, where she was an All-American in cross country. Sarah went on to become a two-time member of Team USA in the 1500 at the London World Champs and at the Indoor World Champs in Istanbul. And Sarah has recently transitioned to the marathon. She debuted at CIM, where she actually won in a time of 2:26:53. She's run Chicago and New York City. She's placed top 10 at both, and she was the top American finisher at the New York City Marathon in 2024. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Sarah Vaughn. All right. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the Fueling Forward podcast.
Hey, Maddie. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy you're here. I know this is a crazy time of year for everything going on in May, so I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to be here. And I'd love to start by having you just tell us a little bit about who you are. You know, I did a little intro, but just in your own words, who is Sarah Vaughn for anyone listening that doesn't know?
Yeah. So first and foremost, I'm a mom of four. We've got three girls and a little boy ranging in ages from 18 to 5. So yeah, every day looks a little different for me and depending on which hat I'm wearing at the moment. But I'm a full-time real estate agent and a professional runner for Puma. So yeah, lots going on, but all good things.
Yes, lots going on, lots of different hats. And I want to start by getting into your experience with starting your running career. What age did you discover running? What did that look like for you getting into the sport?
Yeah, so I actually came to running sort of by accident. I was a gymnast. I was pretty serious. You know, I was going before and after school several times a week. I was like on the verge of, like, I think if I had continued down the path, I probably would have gotten a college scholarship or been able to compete in college. So it was like very serious gymnast, but I grew up in a small town in western Nebraska, and one summer, the summer before my freshman year of high school, my gym abruptly closed. Like, they just went out of business. So I literally showed up, the doors were locked, and I called my mom, and she was like, well, I actually just got an email from the high school track coach, who was also her coach, you know, 20 years prior, and he was like, today's the first day of cross-country practice, open invite if anybody wants to come. And I was like dressed to work out, sort of. I like had a leotard on and like baggy, you know, boxer brief shorts and some like old volleyball shoes, you know, that were on sale at JCPenney. And it was like three blocks away. So I just walked over to the high school and showed up for cross country practice. And I was like, well, I may as well get in a workout if, you know, if I can't work out in the gym this morning. And, you know, didn't know what I was supposed to do or what I was doing, but I like raced a 3 mile run and thought it was so cool and so fun. And that was kind of the end of it for me. I was like, I'm in, this is fun.
That's amazing. So you had no idea that day that you were going to be running?
No clue. And then like, it took me a while. I would say it took me that whole season for my coach to finally be like, hey, you might want to get some other shoes that aren't, you know, discount rack, JCPenney, whatever they are. Yeah. And like, also probably took me that whole freshman year before at least a few of the older girls on the team were like, hey, Sarah, you don't have to race every run. Like, we can jog, we can chat, we can like take it easy. So a huge learning curve for me that freshman year, but no, I had no idea what I was getting into. I had done track a little bit in middle school, but always as like ancillary to gymnastics.
Wow. So that's something I hear a lot from younger kids is like they run, running feels hard because they only know how to run hard. They don't know how to pace themselves. And it sounds like you had that experience. So what was it like kind of learning the sport? When did you kind of figure out, oh, I'm pretty good at this. There might be a better way to do this than run as hard as I can every day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that my coach kind of let me figure it out. He didn't try to like micromanage me every day. I mean, we would do this 4 minute warm-up loop around the school and I would race that too. I just didn't know. And I was probably annoying a lot of my teammates, but I'm really glad that my coach just like was let me figure it out. Because I did learn, like, even if, you know, you're beating someone in a race by a minute or two, doesn't mean that you can't like do 90% of your running with them. So I don't know. I would say it took me cross country season to learn not to race every run, and then probably through track season to learn to really enjoy the company of my teammates. And that was such a gift because some of them are still my best friends. So, yeah, I mean, and it did take some of my older teammates to be like, "Hey, Sarah, knock it off. You're annoying." And I was like, "Oh, I didn't know."
Gotta learn somehow.
Yes.
That's amazing. So, growing up in Nebraska, my mom is from Iowa, actually. So, we would drive through Nebraska every year, multiple times a year sometimes. And I know
Yes.
that it's pretty flat, pretty hot, pretty humid, and just kind of that Midwest feel. And I know just from visiting my mom's family, food in the Midwest is a totally different thing than, food in other parts of the US. I'm thinking like California and places like that. So, what was your relationship with food like growing up? What was food for your family growing up?
Yeah, that's so true. Like super Midwest, if you can think of all like the casseroles and the breads and like lots of butter and lots of canned food. It's funny, I was discussing this recently with a friend. So both sides of my family were farmers, and not far removed from me, like 2 generations ago, they grew all of their own food, including what they grew for a living. And I don't know what changed. Like I think maybe my grandparents' parents going through the Great Depression, but like canned food and boxed food became like a luxury to them almost. And so that made its way into all of our family recipes. So I actually have this beautiful handwritten recipe book that almost everything has some sort of processed food in it. And I think it's,
Amazing.
I mean, it's good food. It's like hearty food. It sustained me through my childhood, but it's like a little bit different than we feed our kids here in Boulder, in the 2020s. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, food was like a part of everything. You know, any you didn't show up empty-handed to any function. And I loved that it taught me that like no food is off limits. I mean, I did grow up a little bit around diet culture. Like I feel like my grandmothers were always dieting with some weird fad diet, but like for me as a kid, everything was put on my plate. Nothing was off limits. I ate a lot of junk food, especially compared to what we give our kids. But it was more like I had enough calories, period. And I also think like I drank at least a glass of milk every day, which was probably a saving grace.
Yeah, that is such a fun thing just to have food be such a central part of your family, both from a career standpoint with farming and also just kind of the centerpiece of meetings and getting together. I think that's something people forget about a lot with food is that it's not just about what it's giving your body, it's also bringing people together and there's memories attached to it, there's emotions attached to it, which can all be great. And I think having that relationship with food from such a young age is so rare. And so I'm curious, transitioning a little bit into college, how did your view or relationship with food change, or did it?
Yeah, it really didn't. I think that I was really well protected, going into college. Like, I was just built up so much as a kid. I was mostly raised by a single father who I think just, and I think these things go hand in hand. And I'm gonna try to make the connection, but like, I think I just grew up with such self-confidence because I heard my dad tell me every day that, you know, I could do whatever I want, I could be whatever I wanted, that going forward just led to like body confidence as well. I never thought twice about body image, really. And even to this day, I kind of am like, I kind of just ignore, you know, the image in the mirror, the number on the scale. I hardly weigh myself. So I don't know. I think like that really protected me going into college when, you know, like stepping into a culture where things were a little different than I had experienced. I just was kind of immune to it. And I thank God for that. So yeah, my relationship didn't really change. And I know like traveling and going to team functions, I was always the kid with like a fuller plate than everybody else. Or I didn't think twice about dating my husband and going to McDonald's after a race. I just rolled with it.
I love that. And I actually had a similar experience where I never really thought twice about any of that stuff growing up. Maybe it's the Midwest culture that we were raised around, but yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge protective factor going into an environment where things can look really different. And like you mentioned earlier, having that sort of all foods fit mindset is really protective. It really helps you navigate new environments a lot easier, and it is super rare. And kind of getting back into that transition into college, so you found running after gymnastics, your gym closed down. How did you end up running in college? You ran for the University of Colorado, which is also where I ran, go Buffs. And that was a powerhouse school. So what did that look like going from, smaller town Nebraska to this powerhouse, cross country and track university?
Yeah, I actually had a step in between. So my freshman year, I was actually at the University of Virginia, which was a total culture shock. I mean, food and everything, but like I just didn't feel like I fit in there. And so coming back to Colorado, my sophomore year felt like much better lifestyle fit. It's only 3 hours from my hometown, even though it's like in many ways a world away. It just felt a lot more connected to like how I grew up and my culture and lifestyle. So I was happy to come back. It was a powerhouse. I again like just carried that self-confidence forward. I tried not to be intimidated by anything. I jumped right in, summer training and just kind of went for it and never really doubted that it was the right place for me. I just trusted it. So that's my sophomore year was a little rough, and then like I think I did go through some body changes early in college, but navigated those okay and was able to run pretty fast before I graduated.
I didn't realize that you went to the University of Virginia before Colorado. So how did you end up at Virginia? Were you recruited out of high school, or was that somewhere you always wanted to go?
No, I was recruited. So the recruiting process for me was so fun because I literally never been east of Omaha, Nebraska. And I
Wow.
got recruited by all these East Coast schools. I visited New York City, I visited Columbia, and then some West Coast schools. So it really opened my eyes. And I just thought at the moment that UVA was the best opportunity for me. I mean, they were offering me a scholarship, but it was sort of the most prestigious university that I was offered to be a part of. And I just thought like that was the right move. I realized when I got there, though, that running was still such a big part of my life that if I wasn't happy or content with that piece of it, that the rest of it wasn't really going to fit either. And I'm okay with that. Like, I used to kind of want to force it. Like, running's not that important and it should be a means to all these other things. But at the same time, it's really part of who I was. And running was not going well and it just wasn't a good fit. So, there was no transfer portal back then. So the transferring was a little more difficult, but it all worked out.
Yeah, amazing. And I like that you said that running is a part of you, but it's important to you. And I think, yeah, like there's kind of this dichotomy where it's either you have to have running be a lower priority and focus on the rest of your life, or it's sort of your entire life. And it sounds like you found that kind of balance and put what would make you happy first. And so I just wanted to ask for your, wisdom for anyone who's listening who is struggling with where they are. If there's a collegiate athlete listening and they're not happy, I'm sure transferring wasn't easy. So what's some advice that you would give a younger athlete who's not happy where they are?
Yeah, it was a little scary, but I think it's a lot easier now with the transfer portal in general. And I think it's an opportunity. Like, it's not too late to change your mind. And I don't regret the mistake. I think it was really eye-opening and I learned a lot for that year, but I was really happy that I had the opportunity to transfer. I would say if you're in a situation where you're not happy, like seek out something else that makes more sense for you. And we grow so much, especially that first part of college, where the decision you made when you were 17, 18, even 16, sometimes in high school, when you're deciding on this college, you might have grown and evolved and learned to look for something else that you weren't looking for then. So I would say give yourself grace, and move on.
That's such a good point. You're so young when you're making a decision on where to go to college, and the difference between a 17-year-old and a 19-year-old is huge. Even though it's only 2 years, there's a huge difference, and it's okay to put yourself first. This is something I experienced. I ended up canceling a recruiting trip at the very last minute because I knew it wasn't going to be a good fit for me, but I was kind of that people pleaser, which I think a lot of runners are. We don't want to let people down and we don't want to disappoint anyone. That couldn't have been a better choice for me. And I ended up exactly where I needed to be. So yeah, I like that. I like that advice. Just make the choice that's right for you and move on. You don't owe anyone else an explanation. You know what's best for you, which is awesome. So you ended up at CU, which is ultimately where you stayed. And you just mentioned going through a little bit of body changes, which I think is important to highlight because, like I've talked about before, most of us aren't prepared for that. We know that's going to happen at some point in high school, but we don't always know that's going to happen in college. And I think the trajectory of your career is a great example of if you just allow your body to change, you'll adjust and you will get faster and you'll be able to find your way back to feeling good running. So, can you speak to that a little bit? What was that transition like for you?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I definitely gained weight. I think my freshman year, just having access to food all the time, foods that I hadn't eaten before, and just like not, I don't know, like I think also emotionally eating a bit. I was homesick, I was a little sad, and so it was just like a way for me to deal with it. Going back to what I was saying before, like where I feel like I've been kind of immune to it, I remember distinctly having this moment in my dorm where I like my jeans were like super tight, and I was like, oh, I must have left them in the dryer too long. Oh well. Like that was the way I processed it. Definitely didn't like blame myself or feel guilty. I just was like, oh, this is, exterior factor. So like you said, I think just giving myself time, giving myself grace, and eventually you adjust. I mean, the training load went up too, so that like affected my appetite, and I think just figuring out the balance of that, but not like forcing it. I wasn't counting calories, I wasn't like doing math with my food. I was just like, I'm gonna eat when I'm hungry, I'm gonna try to make better choices. And it did, I did like balance out and get faster throughout my college career. I don't know that I had necessarily like lost a ton of weight or got leaner or anything like that. I just think it the training and the calorie intake balanced out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you had that initial reaction of, oh, my jeans shrunk in the dryer. I think that's so important. And I try to tell athletes and anyone in general, clothes are not, you're not meant to fit your clothes are meant to fit you. So if you have a
Yes.
situation like that happening, you can buy a new pair of jeans. It doesn't have to
Yes.
mean anything. It doesn't have to mean that you failed or done anything wrong. And like you said, your body may not have gone back to where it was, and you kind of stayed at this new set point. But it worked really well, and you were able to have a really strong career. You still have a strong career to this day. And so I think that's huge, just allowing your body to shift and, rolling with it. There's going to be good days and bad days, but it sounds like you did a really good job navigating that.
Yeah, thank you. That was exactly right. It just, yeah, just rolled with it. And again, I'm just so thankful for like the mentality I had and the environment I had growing up to sort of like cushion me.
Something I'm very passionate about in the sports performance world is conducting more research with female subjects. Most everything in sports science is based on research done on males, and then the results are applied to women with a shrink it and pink it approach. That's why I'm so excited to be partnering with Hedas for the month of May. Hedas is a female-founded company that produces a high-performance footwear designed based on research done on women, so the shoe better reflects a woman's unique needs. Women have higher arches, a lower ankle bone, upward-angled toenails, and a smaller, more rounded instep compared to males, all of which the Hedas shoe design takes into account. Hedas shoes are both durable and breathable and fit like a glove. I've been running in them for the past couple of months and absolutely love them, and have even noticed my chronic shin splints have gone away. If you're interested in learning more, head to www.hedas.com, that's Hettas, to check them out. One thing to note, as Hedas is based in Canada, online sales to those in the US are paused for the month of May due to tariff changes, but there is stock available at Forward Motion Sports. You can go to their website, forwardmotion.com, and they are hoping to also open a warehouse in the US by the end of the month. And then getting to your junior year of college, this is something that you've shared a little bit about. You had your first daughter, Kiki, while you were in college. What was that like becoming a mom while you were a collegiate runner?
Yeah, so junior year, I was running cross country. Things were like not going great. I was feeling awful in workouts. I was on a hormonal birth control, so being pregnant was like not even an option in my mind. But fast forward a few months, that was exactly what was going on. And so as soon as we found out, we just, embraced the new path. Similarly to things that I had just gone through in my life, it was like, this is the new reality. My body changed pretty quickly. I think also mentally, once I acknowledged, okay, I am pregnant, and then all of a sudden my body was like, okay, let's be pregnant. so it was like pretty quick change. But I think being young and being, I don't know, like maybe a little bit naive, I just thought, I'm gonna be fine. I'm gonna run through this pregnancy. I'll bounce back. I'll keep going. And I think that sort of helped me make that become my reality. And it was also at a time in the running world where there were starting to be a few examples of moms, professional runners who were having babies and coming back. So Paula Radcliffe being the one that sticks out in my mind. I mean, her daughter, her oldest Isla, was a few months older than Kiki. So, on her comeback journey and her coming back to racing, kind of confirmed that like I wasn't delusional, that maybe I could do this. And like Shane Culpepper, a fellow buff, also, she made an Olympic team that year before with a kiddo. So there were starting to be some good examples that was like confirming that I could do it. But it was hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. Did you feel scared at all when you found out you were pregnant at 19, 20?
Yeah, absolutely. That was probably the dominating emotion. But again, like I was really blessed to have a partner who was in it with me. And I just felt like I chose to look at it as a gift. And it was, I think, transferring the year before, coming into Colorado, which was a much more intense training environment, I did sort of start to feel things shifting in my own mind about like food and body image and stuff like that. And so pregnancy kind of A, forced a rest, but B, also forced me to like deal with letting my body do what it needs to do. So I learned that both of those, I think, helped my career in the long run. And then continuing to have children were these big forced breaks away from intense training that made me both adapt to like having to be content with rest, but also, like I said, just like your body's going to change and it'll figure out its way back. And if it doesn't, that's okay too. So it was a kind of a way to force those lessons and drive them home. But being 19, 20, having a baby, I mean, yeah, it was scary. It was hard, but I think it was all ended up the way it was supposed to in the end.
Absolutely. What were the resources, or I should say maybe lack of resources, like for you as a collegiate runner who was pregnant?
Yeah, I mean, there really weren't. There were a lot of changes in the NCAA. I know I've talked about this a lot, but in 2007, the year after she was born, the pregnancy redshirt came to pass, but I didn't have that available to me. I mean, the administration didn't really know what to do. There wasn't a lot of precedent. So it was a lot of figuring things out with Brent and just making it work. We had a ton of supportive teammates. But Kiki had such a cool young childhood with hundreds of aunts and uncles literally on the track team, helping us. And, it's not something that I would want to do again because it was so hard and like just strenuous, but we just did what we had to in the moment, and I think just what anyone would do. We loved our kid and we just made it work. So yeah, I hope that answers your question.
It does. That's so amazing and so inspiring that you were just kind of like, this is where we are and you made it work. I think that's hugely important, whether that's something as big as getting pregnant or just general life changes. You're just so inspiring when it comes to navigating those with grace and just saying, all right, this is where we are. We're going to make it work. And you did exactly that. And not only did you do that, but you've taken that experience and you've turned it into a way to help people. So I know you founded the Vaughn Child Care Fund. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we actually have two prongs. We have a permanent scholarship at CU Boulder for any undergraduate parent. So we've had some amazing stories of people we've gotten to help through that. And then we have just like a universally available child care fund for undergraduate student athletes. And I think things are changing with NIL and opportunities to make money. I mean, Brent and I always think like if that were available to us, we would have maybe been under a lot less stress in college. But regardless, like I just want to make that choice a little easier on someone. Like I feel like if someone's in that position where they're choosing to have a baby or not, in maybe not the most not a situation that they had planned for originally, that the cost of childcare shouldn't weigh into that decision. And I just want to push the needle a little bit towards getting those kids to graduate, because that's to me the most heartbreaking statistic is okay, they choose to have a baby, they're dropping out of college almost, it's like 80 some percent aren't graduating on time. So I just want to move the needle on that a little bit.
That's amazing. That's so incredible that you're doing that. If anyone who's listening wants to help, is there anywhere people can donate or anything anyone else can do to help with this cause?
Yeah, so I believe it's vaughnchildcare.org, and there's a donate button there for sure.
Amazing. That's awesome, Sarah. That's so cool.
Thank
And
you.
I was reading, some articles where you shared your story, and I saw that you had to go to class 4 days after you gave birth to Kiki to
Yes.
not fail.
Yeah. So there's pregnancy policies for like, corporate America and my professors and things like that. But the student policy was if you're in the hospital one day, you get 2 days off of school, and I was only in the hospital for 2 days. So I got my 4 days off of school. I had this lab, and the teacher was young, definitely didn't have kids herself, so maybe lack of empathy there, but she like had it set up and she was like, "You have to come this week or you're gonna fail." And it was like 20% of my grade. So just did what I had to do. Again, I think actually maybe being 19, well, 20 when that was happening was helpful too, because doing that now, I'm like, whew, I don't know.
That's insane. Insane to imagine that wasn't that long ago, first of all.
Right.
And second of all, that you, had to show up at class 4 days later. That's just wild. And like you said, I think like the it's changing a little bit, but I can't even wrap my head around that.
I brought my donut pillow to sit on the metal stool for my science lab. And I mean, again, like there was no, like no shame. I just was like, whatever, this is who I am. Showing up how I was and just got through it.
That is amazing. And I know Kiki is in college herself today, which is crazy. She's probably wrapping up her semester pretty soon here, I would
She's
imagine.
done. Yeah, she's done with
Wow.
class last week. She finished all of her finals. She's got conference this weekend. Hopefully regionals in a couple weeks. So yeah, she's doing it.
Amazing. Wow. And she
Yeah.
is such an incredible kid. I coached at a neighboring high school and they were at a lot of meets together. And so I've gotten to know Kiki a little bit over the years and she's just such a sweet kid. So you guys are
Thank you.
amazing parents and amazing everything that you went through at such a young age to get there.
Thank you. Well, it I think helped shape who she is. You know, she had a really unique childhood and it's really cool. And I think that she's come, now that she's a little bit older, come to appreciate that a little more.
That's amazing. And you are a mom of four. So that was your first of four pregnancies. This is May. This is Mother's Day month. So I wanted to kind of feature some moms. So, I would imagine each pregnancy has been a little bit different for you, especially when it comes to running and transitioning back into running. So tell us a little bit about some things that you've learned, running throughout pregnancy and then postpartum.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Each pregnancy was different. I thought that I had the blueprint after Kiki, and I thought it would kind of be the same, but it really, really wasn't. In fact, my second was like, I mean, if I don't like to use this label, but it was the worst for running. I had to stop running really early. I was super uncomfortable. I was able to come back okay, but then I got injured, and so I learned a lot, I would say, for my second pregnancy about rushing things afterwards. Unfortunately, when you're a track runner, sometimes you have these arbitrary deadlines of like getting fit by, you know, you can't change the date of the national championships or whatever. But I just learned to like try not to think about that and think about my own calendar and what makes most sense for me. So, literally, they were all different. And I think that in general, I alluded to this earlier, but a big break, like 12, 15 months away from intense training, has only prolonged my career. And so, to have that mentality of being really okay with this big break, knowing that like I might be able to tack that in on the end of my career, that would make me feel better. And I mean, so many body changes, not only during pregnancy, labor and delivery, but afterwards, like breastfeeding. I've learned a lot there too, and that like just to accept that, you know, it's really hard to feel like an elite runner while you're nursing. But that's more important than, or for me, it was more important to focus on my babies and feeding them than you're rushing back to running. So this could be like a whole podcast in and of itself. There's lots of things
Totally.
there, but like, yeah, every pregnancy was different. No, never compared. And also, I didn't really like sharing my comeback timeline online. I get a lot of questions about that, but I didn't really like sharing that because I didn't want anybody to compare what they were doing to what I was doing, because it's, you just shouldn't do that. It's so different.
Yes, and I think that's even harder now with social media.
Yes.
So if there is a mom out there who's having a hard time running through pregnancy, maybe can't run through pregnancy and is comparing herself to other people who are, do you have any words of wisdom for someone in that position?
Yeah. Well, I would say, so my third pregnancy, Cassidy, she was one when I made the world team, and I would say that I ran the least with her. So
Wow.
I think if you can just remember that it takes time and give yourself grace, like that's my biggest general advice, but also just know that like if you want it, and if your body can cooperate, if you're gentle enough to it postpartum, like you will get back to where you were before, maybe even better. I think specific advice. This is like maybe a little bit of a soapbox, but I think postpartum, it's okay to stay in bed for like a month. I mean, I'm serious. You don't need to be on the elliptical. You don't need to be going for a walk. If you're bleeding, you should be resting. That's just how I feel. And I learned that, second one, I learned it the hard way. So third and fourth, I did that. And I found my comeback was so much smoother if I really leaned into that rest, like didn't try to jumpstart it in any way. I think it paid off.
That's such good advice. I always am trying to tell runners that in general, rest is okay and rest can actually be more beneficial than pushing through something that's going to end up making it harder for you to come back in the end. So that's incredible. And in terms of the actual fueling piece of for pregnancies postpartum, what can you speak to with that? What were some strategies that you used to stay on top of your fueling throughout pregnancy and then while you were breastfeeding as well?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So, I actually feel like it all has like helped me train my gut in the long run for marathon training too. Because I learned to eat a little bit closer to when I was running and keep my blood sugar a little bit more level. But I think postpartum and breastfeeding, I would have bigger cravings and bigger, I don't know, energy deficits. So I learned to like really stay on top of it postpartum and during breastfeeding. But I, again, no foods were really off limits. I definitely didn't limit anything as far as calories. I always tried to eat more than enough. And then, I figured I'd worry about any extra weight later. And I did do a lot of like where I could, I don't know if you want to call it like shortcuts or whatever, but I would get like high calorie cookies that I could take with me in the car, like lactation cookies or something that, I could pick up and keep with me at all times, because especially, working and raising other kids while being pregnant, sometimes you don't always want to be eating like fruit snacks. So yeah, just like trying to take the time to predict ahead of time that I'm always going to be hungry and to be prepared.
Yes, I think that's huge. And it's funny, Kate Grace, when she was with me on the team, she was talking about how she learned that the hard way. She ended up eating the ends of somebody's gels because she was getting so hungry when she was driving around. So always having food with you. Taking advantage of more nutrient dense, more calorie dense foods is a huge one. Just acknowledging that this is a time when your body's demands are so high and you're giving everything to your babies during pregnancy and while you're breastfeeding. And like you said, just remembering, what are my goals here? My goal is not to shrink my body or look a certain way. My goal is to nourish my kids and to get back to feeling strong and healthy. And you can't do those things if you take shortcuts.
Yeah, exactly. That's so true.
Yeah, and again, your career is just such a testament to how well you've been able to, come back from postpartum and just even see gains in your career consistently. And your career is also so unique in that you've been elite at so many different distances. Like, I saw that you ran the 800 at USA's 1 year, and then you've run the Olympic trials for the marathon. Like, you have been all across the board. So I know as a track athlete myself, I know like you're running higher mileage when you're training for 1500, 5K, but we're not necessarily in that position where we're like fueling a ton during training. So as you transition to the marathon, tell us a little bit about how your fueling shifted and some things that you learned about fueling during your training sessions.
Yes. Okay. So I've seen on your social media that A, you're getting ready to run a marathon. So that's super
I
exciting.
am gonna ask you for advice here in a
Yes.
second.
But also that you always advise to take in calories over a run that's like 80 minutes. Is that your threshold that you
Yeah, like
recommend?
75, 80 minutes,
Yeah.
exactly.
So I learned that also from Dina Castor when I was still on the track. We were training up in Mammoth and I went for a long run with her and I was at the time only racing a mile or less. And she was like, "Where's your fuel? You didn't bring fuel on this long run." And I was like, "I've literally never fueled on a long run. What are you talking about?" And she was like, "Just because you're not running a marathon doesn't mean you don't need to fuel." And her point too was like a recovery standpoint. She's like, "You're putting yourself in such a calorie deficit. You're gonna hurt your workout on Tuesday if you're not fueling on this Sunday long run." So light bulb went off there. So luckily I did get to practice a little bit of fueling on long runs for a few years before I switched to the marathon. But I think for the marathon, I love that the training I get to do sort of caters to the stuff I like to eat. Like that kind of goes hand in hand anyway. I'm a big carb and sweets person. And, I joke about it a little bit, but like it also fits really well with kid lifestyle, like a lot of pasta, a lot of bread. I mean, that's what kids like to eat anyway. And I always felt like I needed to be improving or like making my own meals separate from my kids. And I was never good at that anyway. So I love that the marathon is like a little bit more forgiving with nutrition. So yeah, I just, again, lots of calories all the time.
Yes, I love that. I had the same experience where I learned fueling during long runs, even though I wasn't a marathoner, was hugely important. Honestly, probably a couple years after college when I was doing like 16-mile long runs, I mean, you're out there for hour 45 and you do feel it afterwards. Like, yes, I got through those runs, but I never felt like I recovered well. I was totally dead to the world the rest of the day. And adding that fuel in during from a recovery standpoint was huge for me. And you're absolutely right. That next workout was so much better. And then you can string together more consistent days. And that's when you really see those improvements. So not just marathoners benefit from during
Yes.
run fueling.
So true. So true.
Yes, but I would imagine that during the marathon, during your training, it's a lot more intentional, a lot more targeted than just during your long runs as a middle distance runner. So, what were some shifts you had to make, and what worked well for you? Maybe what didn't work well for you with your during race fueling or during training fueling?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that was trial and error. During that first marathon buildup, I wasn't really thinking of myself as a marathoner still. I just thought, okay, I'm doing all these mileage weeks to get ready for the track season next spring, but I'm gonna just try a marathon at the end of this to see how it goes. So I don't know, this sort of speaks to my like type B relationship with nutrition planning, but I was just kind of like trying all the things. And I remember being on a run with some friends, and they were like, "Oh, you should try Morton gel." And I popped it in my mouth and immediately spit like threw up, like gagged. So that wasn't it. But I had been using scratch products for years, and luckily developed a relationship with Alan close enough that I could be like, "Alan, what should I be doing?" Because I don't want to have to think about it. Like outsourcing certain things from my brain is the only way I can operate. So I didn't want to calculate grams per body pound of body, I don't know, just tell me what I should do. So he literally just like spelled it out for me, like, "Hey, you need to take 4 ounces of super fuel mixed at this, the formula that's on the back of the package, and then maybe a gel at 30K." And so that's what I did. And actually, my first marathon, I probably overfueled. I was like scared, didn't know what I was doing, so I was always watching other people, and I saw somebody take a gel on the start line, so I was like, "Oh, I'm gonna do that too." And then I saw, like I just was just doing what everybody else was doing, but didn't bonk, and that was, I think, the thing that I was most scared of. So anyway, long story short, that's my fueling strategy, is I do scratch super fuel, 4 ounces every 5K, and I try to practice that as much as possible during training as well.
Yes, that is huge. Practice, practice, practice. Try new things. That's also a benefit to fueling during training is you can practice for the race. The race should just feel like another long run, essentially. It's something that you should really know what works. You've tried it before, the intervals, the amount of fuel, all the things. And that's the best way to know what's going to work. And like you said, you tried that Morton in practice, and thank God, because if you had done that on a race, that would have been a huge bummer. And that's so funny. You're actually the fourth athlete that I've heard have that exact reaction to
Oh,
Morton,
interesting.
where you it like hits the back of your throat and you immediately throw it up. But then
I
I have
use
some
lots of
athletes who
coconut.
love it.
Yeah, so
Right.
many people use it. And that's why that it was offered to me. They're like, "Everybody uses this. It's gonna be great." I wish somebody had prepared me that it kind of has the consistency of snot. And then I might have been able to get it down, but it wasn't for me, so that's all right.
Yes, no, I know. And that's the thing is it's such a personal preference. Like everybody is so different. So like you just said, watching people around you and doing what they were doing with their fueling didn't work super well for you. But when you figured out a plan that did work, that's kind of when you were able to lock that in. Yeah, so finding what works the best for you, not just doing what other people are doing. But despite not really feeling like you knew what you were doing in your first marathon, it went really well. You won CIM, and that had to have been one of the faster debuts in the marathon, right, by an American?
I think at that time I was like fourth or fifth on the list. I think I've gotten bumped down a few spots since then, but yeah, it was, and you know, I think what made it go so well is that I did fuel a lot, and I was super conservative. So I knew that I just, like, at that, we went from going like arbitrary goal of 2:45, because that used to be the trials qualifying standard, and then they moved the qualifying standard while I was training. So I was like, okay, maybe 2:37:30 or whatever it was, maybe I can do that too. And then just kind of kept shifting, and then even as the race unfolded, I had no idea what pace I was on. But I think being conservative, trying to make sure I had a positive experience so that, well, I think that was Brent's master plan. He was coaching me at the time. I was like, this is a means to an end. I'm doing this so that I can get better at the 5K maybe, or the steeplechase. But he was like, no, let's have a really positive experience so that you maybe want to do another marathon. And that's how it ended up.
Wow. And that stuck. And here you are still doing marathons, absolutely crushing marathons. And for anyone out there who maybe is running their first marathon this fall at New York, what advice do you have for anyone who's getting into the marathon, or just generally navigating the race itself with the intimidating distance of 26.2 miles?
Yeah, I mean, I think respecting the distance is huge. I think definitely going slower than you think you should the first 10K, even the first 20K, so that you can finish well. I mean, if you feel well, you can make up a lot of time in the second half of a marathon. And I think that's such a better way to experience your first marathon than going out and suffering. Which is what I did on my second marathon, and it was so rough. So I think, yeah, just making sure your first marathon experience is positive and that you get to the finish line thinking, okay, that was hard, but I want to do another one and I think I can run a little faster. That should be the goal. For New York specifically, I would practice fueling with calculating that bus ride in there. So if your fuel requires you to be at home in your kitchen, maybe you figure out a different strategy of like being able to eat on the bus, because there's a lot of waiting time, especially for the masses at New York. I mean, even for us as pros, we actually last year got stuck behind a car wreck on one of the bridges, and then the bus ride to the start line was even longer than usual. So luckily I had everything with me that I needed, and then the warm-up was a little bit abbreviated. So I would practice incorporating that like long wait time.
Yes, that's such a good piece of advice. You end up out on Staten Island and then you're just kind of there hanging out waiting. So yeah, definitely a huge thing, because the buses are so early and the start is so much later. I mean, it is like 3 hours or more for some people between leaving to get on the bus and starting the race. So that's a really good reminder to make sure you're thinking ahead for that and planning ahead for that as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And going back to what you said a little earlier about how your marathon diet is very kid friendly, this is something that I think is huge, is just modeling for your kids that it's okay to eat these foods and not making food a big deal. And especially since you do have, you know, 3 daughters, and there is always, I think, I mean, boys have this too, but for girls especially, I think there is a lot of pressure to look a certain way or eat a certain way. And with social media, they are exposed to those ideas at such young ages. What are some things that you've done in your family to foster a healthy environment around food and a safe environment for your kids?
Yeah, so you highlighted one of the things that I've always really tried to keep up front with our food, is that no food is bad food. We don't label food. This isn't a good food. This isn't a bad food. It's all just food. And there's a place for everything in our diets. I think, you know, going to a birthday party, but having to miss out on certain things because of, like, I don't know, you it's good or bad, or we never wanted to put that experience on our kids. We wanted them to be able to eat and enjoy everything. So I've just really tried to model that, even if I didn't want to. Like, I don't always want dessert, but if it's offered, I'll eat it just to show my kids, like, it's okay. I will, yeah, we offer all kinds of food. So we've sort of had the mentality of, like, pushing that there's no, we're not going to label foods good or bad. And we also don't really talk about each other's bodies, or like, that's just kind of a rule in our house. And sometimes I've had to put some boundaries up with like peripheral family too. Like, hey, please don't talk about your body like that in front of my kids, things like that. So maybe teaching and having the rest of our family learn and get on board with things has been rough at times, but that's really important to us. And then just kind of having the mentality of getting what you need first, like nutrient dense foods. Like obviously it's important macronutrients to get protein, carbohydrates, fats. But then after that, if you're still hungry, then it's like whatever sounds good.
Yes, that's so amazing. I wish so much that more families kind of took that approach. I think it's, you don't realize how much your kids are listening and watching you when it comes to talk around food and body or choices around food. And they really do internalize that. They're looking to you for guidance, for advice, and just allowing them to explore it on their own. You know, kids are in tune with their bodies inherently. Adults are not, because we've been taught, oh no, you're not actually hungry, you're bored, or, you know, maybe be careful that you don't eat too much, or, oh, make sure you finish your plate, even though they're totally full. And those are things that we just lose touch with because sometimes, unfortunately, our environment doesn't allow safe exploration of that. So I think that's huge. And I'm curious, with that approach, have your kids, have you noticed that they're, you know, not super picky, or they're good at listening to their bodies, or anything like that?
Yeah, I think they're all really good at listening to their bodies. And I mean, knock on wood, we still have some like of the preteen teenage girl years to navigate ahead of us. But so far, so good. And I think I just love that like they don't label foods, they don't label their bodies, and like I don't know, they kind of seem to be like me where they're just like disassociating with like I don't know, there's not a negative connotation to any one meal, or they'll eat fast food without hesitation if that's what's available. So yeah, I think it's working. And also, like you said, I wanted to reiterate too, like the clean plate club is not, we let them listen to their bodies. If they're full, they're full. We don't make a big deal about it. And you know, kids are growing, and they grow in spurts. So there's some days where my 9-year-old eats like a grown man for 3 or 4 days in a row, and then she goes back to eating like a bird for a week. And you know, I don't label it. I don't call it out. It just is what it is. So yes, we try to lean into that pretty hard.
That's amazing. Yeah, we're not robots. Our bodies don't need the exact same things every single day. It's going to change, and that's why we have those hunger and fullness cues that also change. And so, yeah, allowing them to explore that on their own is huge. And I love what you said earlier about setting boundaries around food and body image talk. This is a huge one that I talk to a lot of my athletes with, and it can be really hard to tell people that you don't feel comfortable with some of the things that they're saying. So, do you have any advice on how you've navigated that with family?
Yeah, I do. It is uncomfortable sometimes when you have to be like, "Hey, grandma, like we're not going to talk about our bodies that way in front of our kids." And it can be awkward at first, but I think every single time I've had to do it, the person whom I'm talking to doesn't even realize that they're doing it, and it's actually usually really eye-opening and educational for that person. So if you can find a way to do it with grace and kindness and just say like, "Hey, we're just really trying to talk positively about our bodies and ourselves. We're not trying to put ourselves down. And even if, though you're talking about your own body, you're doing it out loud in front of my kids. This is the impact it has on them. Can we try to not do that?" And every single time it's been okay. Like it's sometimes a little scratchy at first, but like I said, almost every time I've had to bring it up, the person isn't even aware that they're doing it. It's so ingrained in them, and it's not their fault. It's the way they grew up. It's their brokenness that they've had to deal with their whole lives, and it's I don't know, it's like changing those generational habits. It's hard, but it always is for the better. So I would say just go for it.
Yeah, that's such great advice, and you're absolutely right. People don't realize, I think, how deep-seated these thoughts and beliefs are, until maybe somebody points it out to them. And you're absolutely right. A lot of people don't realize that they're doing it, and they don't want to do that. They don't want to be that person. And so I think it helps everyone really to bring that to attention. And you don't have to just like sit there and take it, essentially. If that's something that you're experiencing often, it's okay to set boundaries around that stuff. It's okay to protect yourself, protect your kids, and it actually might benefit everybody involved because they may not realize how harmful their comments are.
Yeah, that's so true. I've also practiced these scenarios with our kids and like having an arsenal of comebacks, for lack of a better word, like graceful, kind comebacks, but saying like, "Hey, can we talk about something else besides my body?" Or "I'd appreciate if we switched the subject," just so that they're prepared. Because I remember as a kid sitting there and just taking it, listening to it, and luckily I was able to not internalize those things. But yeah, like you said, protecting our kids is worth any uncomfortable conversation.
Yeah, that's so amazing. That's such good advice too, to give your kids some tools to work with, because you can't always be there to have those conversations for them or set those boundaries for them. And that's amazing. You're equipping them with those skills. That's something I tell athletes all the time. You know, if someone's saying, "Wow, you're gonna eat all of that. How are you gonna stay lean and fit?" It's okay to say like, "Hey, I know what my body needs. I don't really feel comfortable talking about this. Can we talk about your week at work?" Or pick a new topic, change the subject. Like you said, it's okay to set those boundaries, and that's so incredible that you're practicing that with your kids. I love that.
Thanks. Thank you.
That's
I've
so
learned a
great.
lot.
I'm sure. And no one's perfect, right? Like, there's gonna be times where you mess up or you say something that maybe you wish you wouldn't have, but you can acknowledge that too and say, "Hey, I said this, I probably shouldn't have. Here's why. Let's move on and not do that." It sounds like a theme for you guys is acknowledge and move on, and I love
Yes,
that.
that's so true. That's great. That's a good way to boil it down for sure.
Yeah, such an accepting environment, which is amazing. Any last pieces of wisdom for families looking to create a good environment around food for their kids?
Man, I think we've hit on all the highlights. We don't, like I said, we don't have a lot of rules, so I don't really know that there's anything that I can add to the conversation. I think we did great. We covered a
I love
lot.
that. I love it. I think that was super helpful. And just kind of wrapping up with where you are right now, what's next for you? What are you training for? What's on the calendar?
So right now I'm in kind of an awkward season where I'm going to pretend to be a track runner again for a little while. Whether or not
Amazing.
I race on the track is yet to be determined, but I'm going to do some shorter stuff relative to the marathon. I know I've always like skipped over this 5K, 10K training, so I'm kind of focus on that for a little while. No races that I can talk about on the immediate schedule, so yeah, to be
Understandable.
determined. Yeah.
We'll keep our eyes peeled for any announcements from you. If people want to keep up and hear what you have maybe announced later, where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm most active on Instagram. SME Vaughn is my handle.
Awesome. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this, Sarah. You have such an inspiring story. I'd love to wrap up our session with our fun rapid fire questions if you're ready.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, perfect. So our first question, what is your go-to pre-run snack?
I'm toast and jam every time.
Me too. I love what jam flavor? What's your jam?
Strawberry only.
Yep. Okay. I like raspberry actually.
Okay. Too, I
That's
don't know, it's
okay.
too
I like
seedy
strawberry.
for me. Yeah.
Yeah, it does really get in my teeth. I understand that. What would you pick for your last meal?
Oh man. A steak. I gotta go back to my Nebraska Midwest roots, like a really good cut of steak and some fries.
Yum. That's one of my favorite meals, steak and fries.
Yes.
What is your favorite dessert?
I like a lot of desserts, but probably, especially now that it's warm, I'm gonna go with ice cream.
Same. We have a lot in common.
Yes. The Midwest again. Iowa,
It
Nebraska.
is. It is. Yeah. What is your least favorite food?
I don't like broccoli. For some reason, all my kids love it, so I end up cooking it a lot. And they like it the worst prepared way, which is like steamed, which is just gross mush. So I can tolerate it if I can like roast it crispy, but I just don't eat it if I make it the other way.
I love that you're making food for your kids that you don't like. I think that's something that's important, is to give them that exposure, even if you don't like a food. So
Yes.
that's another little
Thank you.
tidbit in there.
Yes. Yeah.
If you could travel anywhere in the world for a food experience, where would you go?
Italy. I just want all the pasta all the time. We've been to Italy a few times and had some amazing pasta and also wine. I mean, Italy.
What better place?
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. What is your go-to lazy meal?
Geez, I have a lot. I mean, pasta is one of them for sure. I feel like that's a lazy meal. And then we also do kind of like a whatever's left in the fridge curry, where I cheat and just totally buy like a can of coconut milk and then the paste and it's like whatever leftover, chicken and veggies and throw it on rice. Good enough.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, we do
That
that a lot.
sounds
I
good.
do a lot of crock pot meals too.
Yeah, those are the crock pot is a saving grace for sure for busy runners.
Yeah, for sure.
And then our last one, what is your favorite coffee or tea drink?
I am just a drip coffee whole milk gal. I
Love it.
really hardly order anything else. Occasionally iced if it's like over 80 degrees, but I'll drink hot coffee when it's 75, 80 degrees. It's just better in my opinion.
I'm the same way. I'm a
Nice.
hot coffee girl.
Nice. I love it.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. I'm excited to hear what's on the schedule this fall. Good luck with the track, and we'll be cheering for you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast. If you'd like to keep up with Sarah, you can find her on Instagram at SMEVaughn. Next week's episode will be a Q&A with me, your host, Maddie Alm. If you would like to submit a question to be answered on air, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.